So my name is Jeremy Height, and like I said, I serve as the Director of Church Relations at Shepherd Community Center in Indianapolis. We're a Nazarene Compassion Ministry and a Nazarene church, and I get to share Shepherd's story a lot. And the basis of this workshop is based out of something that Dr. J.K. Warwick says in the book The Heart of Holiness, which is, how do we as churches be centers of compassionate ministry and evangelism? And what does that look like in the local church? And in this book, there's several people, a lot of them from Olivet, but also including my father, a guy named Jay Height, who he serves as the coordinator for Nazarene Compassionate Ministries for USA Canada. And we'll share some stories from ministries that that we at Shepherd get to partner with through that partnership, and talk a little bit about how we can live out compassion in the local church. A little bit about me. This is a really bad... let me turn this off for a second so you can see. This is me and my wife, Ritu, and we're at the Agra Fort in northern India near the Taj Mahal. My wife's from India, and we got to lead a mission trip from Olivet about 2 years ago. And I'm a complete history nerd, and so this is one of my favorite places I've ever been. It was built and lived in by the guy who built the Taj Mahal, and they have like a really big moat and a lot of battle defenses that are really cool. But my wife and I have been married 3 years. We both went to Olivet, but we met at Shepherd Community Center, both doing an internship there a couple years ago. And then Shepherd Community Center, where I work, my family's been a part of Shepherd for 21 years. Shepherd's been around 31 years. We were started by Dr. Warwick. He commissioned a group when he was a pastor in the suburbs of Indianapolis to a Nazarene church in the inner city of Indianapolis that was on the brink of closing, and they did a Thanksgiving outreach, and God lit a fire in those guys' hearts. The guy who ended up starting is a guy named Dean Coles, who served in Indianapolis, yeah, you know, and in Colorado, and is now in Kenya with his wife. And our goal at Shepherd Community Center is to break the cycle of poverty. And we aim to do that by working with children and their families from the age of 0 to the age of 25 through education and the love of Christ. And I'll mention a few stories of how we're seeking to do that in our community and throughout the discussion. So to kind of start it, share a story to kind of frame our discussion, and I'll share a little bit of a roadmap. We'll talk about why compassionate ministry, at least in my opinion, is important. Some examples and some tips on how we every local church can live out the compassion of Christ, and then we'll have some time at the end to discuss anything that you guys have question-wise or to continue the discussion. So there's a story about a first century rabbi by the name of Rabbi Akiva, who he lived first century AD, shortly after the time of Jesus. And we're told that one day he was walking home from Capernaum, doing what any good Jew would have done during that time, which is meditate on Scripture, reciting it over and over again. And we're told that by the story that he was repeating one particular passage of Scripture. And it was Isaiah 43, verses 10 and 11. And it says, "But you are my witnesses, O Israel, you are my servant. You have been chosen to know me, believe in me, and understand that I alone am God. There is no other God, there has never been, and there never will be. I, yes, I am the Lord, and there is no other Savior." So Rabbi Akiva was walking home from Capernaum, reciting this, meditating on this, kind of in the God zone, and he was so focused on this passage of Scripture that when he came to a fork in the road, and where he should have went left to take him home, he accidentally went right. And he didn't realize his mistake until sometime later, as darkness set in at dusk, and he came up to a Roman fort in the road. And he heard a voice shout from the impending darkness, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" And it kind of shook him out of his God zone. And he looked up and saw a Roman guard at the top of the gate. And all I could really eke out was the question, "What?" So the Roman guard repeated the two questions, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" And rather than answering those two questions, the rabbi responded with a question of his own. And he said, "How much do they pay you to ask people these two questions?" That kind of took the guard back a little bit. But after a second, he responded and said, "About 2 drachma a week." A drachma being about a day's wage during that time. And the rabbi, with great conviction, we're told, shouted back at this Roman guard and said, "I will pay you twice that if you come home with me and every morning ask me those same two questions. Who are you and what are you doing here?" And for us, as Christ followers, as leaders in the church, I think how we answer these two questions will dramatically impact what our lives look like. So going out on a limb, since we've already, you guys have already mentioned the churches and ministries that you're involved in, that you probably are a Christian, and that for us, the answer of who are you is defined as a loved child of God. We're disciples of Christ. We're one of my favorite books of the Bible is 1 John, and in 1 John 3, the writer tells us that, you know, see what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are. And for us, being loved children of God, loved daughters and sons of Jesus as disciples of Him, that being our identity will dictate what our lives look like. And as to the question, what are you doing here? I think the answer to that is actually in the passage of Scripture that Rabbi Akiva was reciting and meditating on that day. And in that passage, it says, you are my witnesses. And for us in the church, the work that we do, we're to be witnesses of Christ. We're to show, we are loved, that is our identity, and to share that love with others is the work that we're put here on earth to do. And one of the most important ways to be a witness of Christ in our world, at least in my opinion, is compassionate ministry. I would define compassionate ministry as the work of Christ followers in churches to meet the tangible and spiritual needs of others. It's when Christ followers meet the needs of others and demonstrate the love of Christ. And, you know, in hearing that, you might be thinking, okay, well, that helping others and telling them about Jesus, isn't that just what the work of the church is anyway? And that's exactly the point. Compassionate ministry isn't us creating a new program, something that the church hasn't done for years, some new discovered way to bring people into the church. The term compassionate ministry is just putting a name to the outreach and loving work that each of our churches is already doing. It's defining work that's already happening. And compassionate ministry is important because, very simply, it's Christ-like. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, we're told that we are comforted by Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies, God of all comfort, who comforts us in all of our affliction so that we may be able to comfort those in any affliction. And then in Matthew 25, passage that's very well known, when at the end of all time, Jesus separates those from the right and the left, and the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? And the king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. And for me, this is a convicting passage of Scripture because it not only communicates the importance of compassionate ministry, but it makes it sound like, at least in my reading of it, that if we are not bearing the fruit of a life of compassion, our path into heaven might be a little bit more difficult than we would expect. And then elsewhere, in Proverbs, we're told that whoever is kind to the poor lends to the Lord, and whoever oppresses the poor shows contempt for their maker, but whoever is kind to the needy honors God. Tom Neese, a great leader over the years within the Nazarene Church, put it this way in his book, Compassion Evangelism. Evangelism, as commonly understood, is true the gospel only when it is as sensitive to physical and temporal distress as to the hungry heart. When we're meeting the spiritual needs and the physical needs of the people that we are serving and living life with. And then one last passage of Scripture, one that I've been wrestling with over the last several months, is out of Mark chapter 1. And we're told, this is a story of a very short story of a miracle that Jesus performs. This man with leprosy came to Jesus, begged him on his knees, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Jesus was indignant. He reached out his hand and touched the man. I'm willing, he said, be clean. And immediately the leprosy left him, and he was cleansed. It goes on to tell us in the next few verses that Jesus then does what he often does, which is he tells the man, go and tell no one of what I've done. And immediately the man goes and tells everyone what Jesus did, because apparently he wasn't really good at following instructions. But for me, the reason that I've been wrestling with this over the last several months is that three-word sentence kind of in the middle of the story. We're told that this man with leprosy, faced with this great injustice of this debilitating disease, comes to Jesus, asks him to heal him. Something happens in the middle, and then Jesus meets that need and heals him. But the thing in the middle is that three-word sentence, Jesus was indignant. This is from the NIV, and a few other translations say it this way. And it didn't make sense to me that Jesus would be indignant. My definition of indignant would be frustrated, ticked off, and a little bit angry. And there are several times in Scripture that Jesus is frustrated, ticked off, and a little bit angry, but usually he's tossing tables when he is. And he's not doing that here. So I could not understand why Jesus, being presented with this need, seemed like annoyed, and yet he still healed the man. And so I dug into it a little bit and found out, well, one, not every translation of the Bible translates it this way. There are several translations that say Jesus was filled with compassion, which makes a whole lot more sense, right? Jesus is faced with this need. He's filled with compassion for this man faced with leprosy, and then he heals him. But it still didn't answer the question for me of why then does my translation, amongst others, say that Jesus was indignant. And I'm not a Greek-Hebrew scholar at all, but I did what any good millennial does, and I went and Googled it and went online and tried to figure out exactly why some translations say Jesus was indignant and Jesus was filled with compassion in other places, and pulled out some commentaries and whatnot, and found that this word there on the bottom, that's the word that is translated indignant or filled with compassion. And it's a word used only 12 times in the New Testament, and it talks about to be moved with compassion from the center of our being. During that time, the understanding was that our emotions centered in our bowels. So to be moved with compassion from our bowels, that's the word here. And so Jesus, faced with this terrible injustice that this man is living with, he was, from the most central part of his being, moved with compassion. This righteous anger from his bowels, and he healed the man. And so this is used 12 times in the New Testament. Almost every time it's talking about Jesus, but every time that it's used, it talks about someone who was moved with compassion from the center of their being, and they did something about it. And for me, this was the most convicting part of this passage, was that in my own life, if I see a need, if I see a person in need, an injustice in a situation or in a system, and I don't do anything about it, my feeling of empathy doesn't really mean much. And even more so, it's not Christ-like. If I want to live a life as a disciple of Christ, being like him, having his compassion, then I have to do something about whatever feeling. Compassion cannot exist without action. My wife was leading a Bible study a number of weeks ago and put it this way. She said that compassion is having your heart broken and doing something about it. She's much more succinct than I am. I mean, I just took like 15 minutes to get to that point, and she summed it up like that. But for me, this is where I serve at in Indianapolis, we do what we do. But it's the reason that we, as wherever we are serving in local churches, do what we do. It's because we're trying to introduce people with the love of Christ, and we have to do it in action. Anytime we live out his compassion, it has to move us to action. So what can this look like? Here are seven, what I call seven important keys to compassionate ministry. I figured if it's good enough, if numbers and lists are good enough to get people to read stuff on Facebook, then it might be good to have in a presentation. These seven, coming from my own studies and my undergrad and master's, I got a master's in urban ministry from Olivet, but then also from everyday experience of our compassionate ministry in our church in Indianapolis, as well as throughout USA Canada. So let me break down these a little bit. The first one, define your neighborhood. I think one of the biggest things that we could learn from our Catholic brothers and sisters is the idea of a parish, of owning a neighborhood wherever your church is. I heard a workshop last week, and I heard some pastors who were talking on doing ministry in rural and small towns, something that I don't really have any experience in growing up in downtown Indianapolis. But they mentioned this almost exactly to the point of saying, you know, what would it look like if you were to take a pencil and just draw a 2 to 3 mile circle around your church and said, we as a church are going to own this neighborhood. No matter what the community may look like and what it may look like in 15 to 25 years, what if we commit to staying here and serving our neighbors, whoever our neighbors are, whatever our neighbors may look like and whatever they may do. Defining where you're going to serve in seeking to make impact in compassionate ministry is important. And as you define it, it's also important to get to know the neighborhood well. There's a number of organizations that that talk about this and talk about going and doing what we in Indianapolis term a listening tour, going door to door and doing surveys, and not only asking our neighbors what is needs and going wrong in the neighborhood, but even more importantly saying what's going well. Like, what do you love about this neighborhood? If you've been here for any number of years, what are your favorite parts about it? What are the brightest parts of it? And finding the positive momentum that's already happening in the neighborhood. And then as you're getting to know your neighborhood better, and no matter how long you're in a neighborhood, you can always know it better. We've been in our neighborhood at Shepherd Community for 3 decades, and we did this this survey about a year and a half ago and realized some very large components of our neighborhood that we didn't understand or that we weren't aware of. The second one, engaging your church's passions as figuring out what are the areas of need and the areas of assets in the community, also realizing that within our own congregations. As a lead pastor or as anyone in leadership in a church, if you start a new initiative and don't have any buy-in from everyone that you're going to need to help with it, it's not going to get very far. And while there may be needs or opportunities in the community, if it doesn't intersect with our congregants' passions and what God is calling them to, it's not going to get very far. So finding the intersection of needs and movement in the community along with the passions and the callings of those in our churches. The third one, don't be afraid to be unique in community engagement and compassionate ministry. There's no one-size-fits-all approach because every community is different. Some examples of this from some pastor friends that I know and stories that I've heard are a pastor who started a board game night. Absolutely loves board games. Him and his wife have 50 to 60 board games. And when a local coffee shop opened up in their neighborhood, they just went and asked if they could host board game nights on Saturday nights. And a friend of mine in Indianapolis, and he invited several of us to the first several weeks of it at the get-go to get momentum. And now on an average week, they'll have anywhere from 1 to 2 dozen people, mainly from the community there, playing board games. And him and his wife, as pastors at their church, are getting to connect with people that they have had no other avenue of connecting with, and are able to help out a local business as well. It's not a Starbucks, so it's a local shop, and they are all about that as well. Or it could look like a church that had a good section of land that they hadn't built anything on, hadn't used anything for, but realizing that one of the big hobbies and pastimes in the community was frisbee golf. So they went and bought frisbee golf goals and set it up in this green space and just allow people to use it. They will do picnics and cookouts, parties in that area, but just have it available to the community as a common space. Yeah, it can look like churches who do oil changes or haircuts based off the skill sets of their congregants, or several churches who, just because they love soccer or basketball or football, go to the local park every week on a set time and a set date and just meet their neighbors. And some play the sport, some sit on the side and get to meet those who are the moms, the parents that are watching their kids, and getting to build relationships with them. Number four, starting small. We don't have to solve all the problems in our neighborhood with one initiative, because the thing is that we can't. But we can make a difference by starting somewhere. So being feeling free to start small and having those small successes grow into something bigger is a great mode, not only for entrepreneurial business, but also for ministry. Because starting big and failing means a lot of lost money and burnout people and a lot of lost momentum. But if we start small with an initiative and it doesn't work out, we have all the freedom to re-up with something else without having expended all of our resources. But also don't be afraid to be aggressive. Starting small, yes, but working aggressively to make that small start succeed and grow. And then number five, aim for quality. And this is one in Indianapolis at Shepherd that we've interacted with to some degree, that in whatever we do in ministry, our service should be a quality. And that whether it's a program that we're running or that we're supporting, whether it's food, clothing, or initiative, that it's quality. You know, on a number of occasions over the years, we have had some very loving donations of trash. I think a good rule of thumb is if you're not willing to use it or eat it, you shouldn't donate it or give it out. Whether it be food, for us, one of the things we realized in our neighborhood, not even necessarily something that had been used beyond the point of really being able to use it anymore, one of the things that we realized in our neighborhood is that when we learned that high blood pressure was the number one killer in our neighborhood because we don't have a grocery store within walking distance. So we have a food pantry, and we have for a number of years, but are wrestling with the reality that when we give out canned food, we're contributing to that problem. And how can we address that? And so we're working with organizations that are much more knowledgeable in gardening and fresh produce to try to be able to provide that for our neighbors in order to address that need. Because as much as meeting the tangible need of eating today, if we want them to have a long and happy life, we need to make sure that we're meeting a lot of real needs. Number six, giving a hand up over a handout. In our compassion and outreach, we should aim to empower people and not just give them a handout. Our compassion should be helping them step in the direction of getting back on their feet while also communicating their value now. What does this look like? It can look like when we do home renovations, inviting the homeowners to help us with that. There's a ministry in Indianapolis that builds ramps for homes with families that need wheelchair access. And for a number of years, they would show up on a Saturday morning and build a ramp. And it would take most of the day to do. And our assistant director was meeting with them a number of years ago and talking about it and saying, you know, do you invite anybody from the family to help with it? And he said, no, you know, we often see people like some kids, 17, 18, 19-year-old guys and young women who could probably help with it, but we don't invite them because we just want to help them. And sometimes they'll offer to give us meals, but we don't want to take anything from them. They slowly began to change that and found that not only was it a more meaningful experience in building relationships with this family, but it also meant that the upkeep of those ramps was much more sustainable when they started requiring volunteer help from friends or family members of the house that they were working on, and when it was offered sitting down for a meal with those families, being able to build relationships with them over food. This can also look like client choice food pantries, where people are able to go through and pick their own items at a food pantry. Asking those that we're helping to contribute as well, because everyone can contribute something, time, effort, or even small financial contributions. Then we're not only helping them physically, but we're also communicating the fact that we believe that they have something to offer and that they have worth, that they're not completely helpless. One church in Indianapolis that has kind of went on this journey of moving from giving a hand out solely to doing more of a hand up is a church that they, old Presbyterian church that several decades ago was trying to figure out if they wanted to leave the neighborhood because during the whole white flight and the kind of downhill slant of Indianapolis's inner city, just like in a lot of cities in USA, most of their congregants started driving in, and they were trying to figure out if they wanted to move out of the community. They ended up not, partly because they had such a old and beautiful building that they were never going to be able to afford to replicate it. But in the midst, there were some people within their church who wanted to help meet the needs of those in their community. And so they started a food pantry in which they got one of those stable doors where you can move the top and the bottom independently of each other. On a side door down in the basement of the church that had an outdoor a staircase, and people could come down and they would hand out food and then they'd go back up the stairs. And then slowly over time, they realized that, well, one, they weren't really getting to know the people, and also that was a really hard thing to do during the winter, and so they started inviting people in for meals. And as they started to sit down with meals with them, started to get to know more of their neighbors. And that went from just being providing meals to inviting those who were a part of it to help volunteer with it. And now, several decades later, they have their own cafe down the block from the church. And everyone that works there, a lot of them, almost all of them are from the community, and a lot of them originating from that very first group that they were serving with. And that they were serving, and over time figuring out how to move from just giving out something to empowering their neighbors to help being a part of the solution. And then number seven, the most important one, is proclaiming Jesus. That in everything we do, that we point people to Him. Because meeting a physical need without trying to introduce someone to Jesus is only half the gospel. Just the same that telling someone about Jesus without showing them His kingdom come through compassion is only half the gospel as well. An example of how we're doing some of this in Indianapolis, you might be able to see on this map, the red dot in the middle is where Shepherd is located, and then there is this yellow, more or less rectangle around it. And this is about 1 square mile around our community, and the first one of defining your neighborhood, that first point, that's what we've done in the last 2 years, of saying that we are going to own this community, that we're going to own the issues. And as we did research and worked with the city, found out that in this area, there's about 6,500 people. And out of that 6,500 people, out of the number of the handful of churches that fall within this rectangle, at most 600, 700 people in church on a Sunday morning out of 6,500. But even more heartbreaking than that is that as we researched that area of saying we're going to own this, what is going on in this community and trying to understand our neighborhood better, found out that that neighborhood has a 200% higher murder rate than the city average, a 340% higher drug overdosage rate than the city, 400% higher non-fatal shootings than the rest of Indianapolis. 30% of the homes in this rectangle are owned, but over 35% of them are either abandoned or have been torn down. And about 19% of the people who live in this are single female households with children. And realizing that in a conversation with the public safety director of our city, a great Christian guy who said, came and met with some of our leaders and said, you know, what you're doing on site is great. You're sharing the love of Christ with people, making some great impact in the lives of children. But quite literally, the neighborhood is still going to hell around you. And realizing that if we wanted to help, our tagline being to break the cycle of poverty, if we were going to do that with these students that we're working with and their families on a day-to-day basis, then we have to be able to help impact the community as well that they're living in. And so we've, over the last 2 years, begun this journey of owning this, and we're calling it the Shalom Project, of wanting to bring peace to the neighborhood. And we started that with our listening tour, the door-to-door surveys to get to know the neighborhood better. And a few ways that we've started to try to take what we've learned and put it into action are in trying to provide more produce. I mentioned that a minute ago. We, several months ago, built about 50 doorframe gardens. They're size of a door, just 4 pieces of lumber. I got a bunch of dirt donated from out in farm country, because all the dirt in our city, like most cities, is contaminated, and provided them for the backyards of families that we work with and in our community so that they can grow produce. We provided seeds and plants, and it's small enough to be manageable, and also in Indy, where it's very likely that we could have frost on some nights depending on the weather, you can throw a bed sheet over it and you don't have to worry about it. One small way that we're trying to help meet the issue of hunger in our neighborhood. We also are doing something that I really, really enjoy, which is we're doing neighborhood block parties. We do them in people's front yards. People that we know, they know we're going to show up. We don't just like pop up and start grilling food on their front yard. We've done this in a number of places now, and our worship band will, a few of the musicians will come and play music, and we will get some food and do, like any good Nazarene church, do a potluck, pitch in and provide food and flyer the neighborhood a few days before, and then just having enough people there, and on most of them we'll do a prayer walk about an hour before we start and hand out flyers to anyone we run into and just pray for that section of the neighborhood, and then just have a party with carnival games and art and music and food in this front yard of different people's homes. The one that we just had was a guy that we actually met on the listening tour, a guy named Bobby, who had not been to church in several decades, and he is a phenomenal artist, is great with spray paint, uses it much differently than he used to. He was a little bit more entrepreneurial in his pursuits around the city, and is now selling his art. And he exhibits his art, show others at this how to do art. And in the process of meeting him, when we did this door-to-door survey, we also have met other artists in the neighborhood and are helping try to promote their art beyond our neighborhood to help them be able to earn a living. And this last one we had in Bobby's front yard. and he invited his neighbors over. And it's a great way to meet neighbors in a less intimidating environment. So this is what it's looking like for us, but some other possible ways to live out some of those seven steps, to live out the compassion of Christ. And I'll pause here for a second and say that this will kind of be the last thing that I share, because I want to leave time for any discussion or questions. I would love to hear how your churches are engaged in your community as well. One, because this is a much different culture out here than where I serve, and I have a lot to learn, and we have a lot to learn as well. I think that's one of the greatest strengths of any church, if on the local level, if we're able to learn and continue to learn from others, as well as our own mistakes and victories, then it makes us all the more impactful. So I'm going to say, are there any questions or discussion, to try to avoid that awkward pause when presenters ask that, and there's that big gap. Because the presenter's done such a phenomenal job of presenting all the material and great clarity and quality. So I'll share this, but then we'll end the time with any discussion or questions that you guys have. And so some other ways of living this out would be being a little league coach, joining. I mentioned like finding out what's going on in the neighborhood, and we don't always have to create something new. In almost all of our neighborhoods and communities, there is good already happening. There is positive movement, and sometimes all we have to do is just join the movement. And being a little league coach, or connecting with teachers and law enforcement. With teachers, providing meals or food throughout the school year, and loving on them. And especially with public school teachers, I would assume it would be similar in your guys' towns and cities, that for a public school teacher, they usually have to provide all of their own school supplies. And doing a drive during the summer to collect school supplies for the teachers of your local public school to just bless them. It's a great way to build relationships. And then one of my favorite things that my family has done for a number of years is providing meals to police and fire departments. My family for a number of years has taken Thanksgiving meal to the local police department. And doing that as a church, well, one, that's a great way to have those police and fighters show up quicker to your church when you have an issue, because they like you. But loving on them and communicating your appreciation for what they do in your community. Another possible way is there's a ministry called WizKids, WHIZ Kids. If you Google it, WizKids Mentoring. If you leave off the mentoring, there was a TV show sometime in the last two or three decades that if you Google it, that's all the main hits. But if you add in WizKids Mentoring, you'll get to the right place. And it was started out of Colorado. There's a ministry in Cincinnati that is using it phenomenally well and is serving hundreds, I think over 1,000 kids every school year. And then we're adopting it in Indianapolis. A couple of ministries are. And what it is it's a one-on-one reading mentoring, tutoring program. So you, as a WizKids tutor, would commit to a year of one-on-one tutoring with the kid for 1 hour a week, and it's a reading-based curriculum. They have the whole curriculum, so if your student's in third grade, and they there's different tiers of it. If they're a lower-level reading student in third grade, there's stuff that you'd print off offline, off the cloud, to be able to read with them, and if they start to get to where that reading is really easy for them, you can move up another level within third grade. And it's great because it provides you all the material, so you as a tutor don't have to create content, or as a leader don't have to. And both in Colorado and especially in Cincinnati, they have a completely open hand mentality with it, of sharing the resources and the training material that they use for teachers. And in Cincinnati, they have gotten to the point where the public schools are coming to this ministry, City Gospel Cure, and saying, can you find churches to adopt our schools? And the model they have in Cincinnati is having one church to one school ratio, and no matter the size of the church, of starting it and having that one-on-one pairing, and being able to impact in the schools like that as well. Another great quote that's in that book, I have a lot of great love and respect for Dr. Warwick, and he said that compassion is a lifestyle. It's not something that we do. It's who we are. It's the heart of a holy God who has filled us with his holy love. Then, it's not simply to love him, but it is to allow him to love us through to love a broken world through us. So that's what I have to share about getting indignant, having the righteous anger of Christ as we seek to love on our communities and introduce them to the good news of the gospel. And then here are a few resources, books, if you can contact me, and I have some material as well, business cards, and then the website right there, usacanadaregion.org. It is the website for our region, and on there is Nazarene Compassionate Ministries subheading in that. There are a ton of resources, papers, articles, and videos from the last several decades that can help, that I find extremely helpful in framing my understanding of ministry, both theologically and pragmatically. So that's what I have to share. I don't know what you guys might have in terms of questions, discussion, or thoughts. And we've got 15, 20 minutes, and would love to discuss stuff if you guys have anything.
We're at a small, we're at a church plant, and currently we're going to be looking for a new location. And as they've been discussing and talking about it, they've often been talking about what it is. Basically, like looking at your list, that's kind of putting the cart before the horse, right? Like, you need to know your neighborhood. You need to get into your neighborhood.
Yeah.
So you can start doing stuff right away to see if that's what would work. But
yeah.
You need to know your neighborhood before you start trying to decide what you're going to do for pastor ministry.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing as in the discussion with international missions of making sure that when you go on a mission trip and what you're engaging in is actually something that's going to help the community. I mean, there are some things that no matter what the community that you're in are going to be good and positive things, but there are some that might not be relevant or at the least just might not be super effective. And getting to understand the feel of the community is a good first step before creating something that might not be a need or might not be big in the community. I mean, if we in Indianapolis tried to connect with hikers because some church in Boise, Idaho does it, I don't know if there is one that does it, but we don't have hills. We don't have anything, really, other than corn. And so there are some things that are applicable, but there are a lot of things that aren't applicable as well. No, yeah, that's a really good point.
Can you tell me more about the
Yeah, we have pulled a lot from the Christian Community Development Association, CCDA. It's based out of Chicago, and their community development organization, and they have a lot of resources, and we have kind of pulled from their wisdom in asking questions. The main thing for us is, one, it starts conversations. It's somewhat dangerous because, at least in the city, there's a lot of pit bulls. So going door to door, sometimes you skip a few houses. But trying to get a feel for what is, for us, it was what is going well, and then saying, are there needs that we're missing? Like the drug epidemic is one that we were completely unaware of. We did not understand the gravity of the drug problem in our neighborhood until we asked our neighbors and also talked with some of the city officials. And in a lot of places, a lot of that information is easily accessible, or you can access it for free. It's looking for it or knowing the right places to look for it. So ours was just like a half sheet with five or six questions. And the way that we did it, and this isn't the only way to do it. We just happened to have several college groups come through on spring break, two spring breaks ago. And so we used their critical mass as college students, and then we sent them out with staff. And so we were able to empower these volunteers to be able to have conversations, get to meet our neighbors, and they were filling out the form and just asking the questions. So one that most of the college students had somewhat readable handwriting, but we were able to get information, and we were able to do more than we could just do with our staff, but still had our staff there. So if in the course of those conversations there was a need or there was a deeper conversation, that we were able to pull them into it because our staff were the ones who were there long term compared to the volunteer groups. Yeah.
So I'm in like a pretty well-established church, whatever, in very white, middle-class neighborhood, whatever. And while physical poverty is not a huge thing, there's definitely a lot of spiritual poverty, like tons of broken marriages, broken families, unhealthy relationships between people, and stuff like that. And we're in like a culture shift at our church where like we have this new staff that's really trying to like, I guess, engage them with the reality that poverty does exist. And so I guess, how would you say this, I guess, practically the best way to engage our people in that reality? Does that make sense?
I think, yeah. Okay. It does. It does. It's...
I guess shifting the mindset from, like, what can the church do for me, and, like, how do we get people in here to act like us and look like us, to... oh, let's flip that around, let's get out of here and go meet people where they're at, mobilize them to, I guess.
Yeah.
And how do we open our eyes to see that there are needs around?
Yeah, exactly.
It's not an easy thing. Yeah. They often say that if you want to, the easiest way to develop a new church culture is just to go plant a church.
Yeah.
I serve as an associate pastor at a 3-year-old church plant, and it's... spending time within that church compared to some of the other churches that I've grown up and served in, it's a lot different. But it in hearing the people who have been there from the beginning, which I haven't, but here, like, they were able to cast that vision. And so then the people that started showing up at the very beginning were the people who bought into that. But for a church that's been developed, it's been around for a number of years, to change that mentality, I mean, any times change is never easy. And especially in organizations like churches, where it's any change that big, at least I would think, I don't know if I've ever seen an instance in which it doesn't come with some type of cost, as in some people deciding that that's not the mission and the vision that they can get behind. But I think from what I've seen, and this... So one of the great things that I love to do, that I get to do and how I serve in Indianapolis, is that I work with our church partners. And a good portion of that is connecting them into the life of Shepherd. But even more so, and some of the biggest, for me, the biggest wins that I've been able to have is helping those churches come, see God light a fire in their congregation, and then they go back and re-engage their community. Because the answer for Indianapolis and the answer for the United States is not 1,500 Shepherd Community Centers. All that we're doing, and it's what any Compassionate Ministry Center is doing, is uniquely living out the call of the local church, at least if we're living out the call right. And so the answer for our country and for our cities is for the local church to live out the calling of the local church, which is to love our communities. And finding people within the church who get that, that aren't staff, that don't, you know, for those who might be more cynical, those who are paid to care, but those who have been in the church for a while, getting those to buy in, that just because of who they are and their investment in the neighborhood and the church can impact others, and finding one small, one small step to start moving in the right direction and building up momentum. What you said was an important point. Not all poverty is socioeconomic. There's emotional and as well as spiritual. And we all have poverty in some regard. I mean, that's why we need Jesus. It's just understanding what our poverty is and understanding the poverty in our neighborhoods. There's a great book that doesn't address spiritual poverty, but it's called... I don't have it listed there. It's called The Framework for Understanding Poverty by a lady named Dr. Ruby Payne. And it is a phenomenal book about understanding not only poverty, She was an educator for a number of years, but it also is great on breaking down poverty, middle class, and upper class, and the differences, and not stereotyping those, but saying, okay, if we were to take a large number of those in middle class, this would be the cultural values. One simple way that Dr. Payne breaks it down in the book is the difference in our understanding of food. So for those in poverty, the focus on food is the focus on quantity. If you go somebody, if you've ever sat down for somebody who is eating or is serving you a meal and they are currently in poverty, they will ask you, like, have you gotten enough? Is there enough? Making sure that you've eaten enough. So that's quantity. And then in middle class, it's about quality. You know, you go to a rather nice steakhouse and they ask you, you know, like, how did it taste, stuff like that. And then if you go to an upper class, there's places where they bring out the food that doesn't really look like, well, food, or like much. They ask you, how does it look? It's all about appearance, and it's not about the quality of the food or the quantity of it, but it's about how it aesthetically looks. That book does a great job of breaking down not just food, but our viewpoints. And for me, growing up in a middle-class family in a poverty context, it helped me understand my neighbors and my friends, as well as the family that I grew up in. And also, it prepared me to go to places like Olivet with people who came from different cultures than I did, and be able to understand the poverty that we all have. Yeah.
So intergenerationally, most specifically, I'd love to hear ideas for children solo, and then also family units, being on the serving side of Compassionate Ministries, not receiving, but what are things you're doing?
Yeah, I think serving together as families is, and I'm preaching to the choir on this one, I know, is absolutely important. It's, for me, growing up as a pastor's kid personally, being involved in ministry with my parents is the reason that I, unlike a lot of pastor kids that I'm friends with or know, that I don't despise the church or my parents, was because it was never just their thing and then it was family, but we were in it together and have been for our whole lives. But being able to provide opportunities for families to serve together is, I think, a great way for parents to be able to model with students. And it also provides more opportunities because it can sometimes be difficult to find projects. From a guy who helps set up work groups perspective, finding projects or events solely for children's groups is a little bit more challenging because, you know, having children serve needy children, that's a weird dynamic, and you don't want to make it look like those who have are better, or like have it more figured out than those who don't. And but serving as families, and the idea of serving with. So a project that we're working on with that I'm working on right now with the church in Indianapolis is they want to come and serve at Shepherd, and they want it to be families. They want to be able to have children of all ages there. And what we're working on is doing a cleanup day at our facility, but then also doing some cleanup at a few homes in the neighborhood, and then a block party. And it won't just be this church coming with their families. We're going to have Shepherd Church families doing a part of it as well. So the kids are able to get to be a part of it, depending on their capabilities, be able to help with either, you know, serving food or just building relationships, and then be able to have interactions between families on a relational serving together rather than one serving another. I think the best solo for kids, some of the best examples that I've seen of it, and granted, I don't have a ton of experience with that. Most of what we do at Shepherd is for high schoolers and older, because we work mainly with elementary students. But is in projects that they do at their own church, and then we give out weekend food packs to our students. 8 out of 10 kids in our neighborhood average one meal a day when they're not in school. And so we send home packs of snacks, Capri Suns, crackers, applesauce, stuff like that. And so we have a lot of churches, and especially children's groups, who the families will collect the supplies, and then the children's ministry, they'll pack the bags and then deliver them. ways of being able to make an impact and hopefully be able to communicate it a little bit and the importance of it and what it's doing, but also in a way that doesn't undercut those who are being served or create a unhealthy sense of dependency or entitlement.
So the Shepherd Community Center is actually a compassion ministry outreach, but it is connected to a church as well.
Yes, yeah. So when we were started 31 years ago, the restart of the church that was there was Shepherd Community Church of the Nazarene is what we restarted as, and then shortly thereafter, Shepherd Community Center, a separate 501c3, was started. And all of the staff at the church serve at the center, but the center is somewhat larger. And but we're on the same property, same location. There's financially and legally there's a separation, but there's a ton of overlap in terms of staffing, facility use. Most of the neighborhood we call it Shepherd or Shepherd Community. We don't. Everything else has kind of gotten dropped off over the years, which I think has been a great benefit and blessing for us because we're able to do for the neighborhood. We're just seen as a church that does a lot of community outreach, and it provides some great opportunities with that.
Then you also invite other groups to come and serve through the organization as well.
Yeah. And when we do it well, it's allowing those groups that come in to have meaningful relational experiences, and using their the people power of work groups to further what's already going on in the neighborhood. It was started at a church that was about to close, and so it was a Nazarene church at the time, and the group that remained there was part of the restart of it with this group that came in from another church.
So was the Compassionate Ministry Center started at the same time as that, or?
A couple years after. From the beginning, there was outreach components of it, but it became a 501c3 a few years after it. Yeah. But
compassion was part of the DNA.
Yeah. Yeah.